Nathan Fielder. Well, this kind of originated from you because you said I had to watch The Curse, his new show starring Emma Stone, co-created with Benny Safdie of the Safdie brothers. And I was like, what streamer is it on? And you're like, Showtime. And I'm like, no one has that. And you're like, I have it. Here's my login information, which I think other people would like. It's on Paramount Plus via Showtime. I think other people would like to watch it, but aren't necessarily wanting to add another subscription. Would it be okay if I just told them your login information?
Obviously, yeah, totally fine. I think so. My stance on this, it's ridiculous. The amount of the add-on that you have to get to Paramount Plus, which is already in and of itself quite unnecessary, other than for the Premier League, is ridiculous. People are like, oh, it's on Paramount Plus. It's not really on Paramount Plus. You have to have Paramount Plus to then get the Showtime extension. If you just have Paramount Plus, it doesn't work, which is ludicrous. Anyway, my stance on streaming services in general is that largely underpriced. I think they really did themselves a disservice by starting off by making them a, even if one show on there per month is good, I'm like, this is probably a decent investment. Plus, I share my password with a bunch of people, and then people occasionally share their other account passwords back with me. So, we got a good thing going on. We got a good thing going on.
Well, and why don't we just, I mean, I
By
feel like this
people,
could
I
be a good
mean
D
other
dib.
people other than Eddie. Eddie has not
I
shared
feel
any.
like, no, I feel like this could be your good D of the day. Listen, for our tens of listeners, I mean, I might screw up your algorithm if you had another 50 people, but like, not
My
50, 50 by 5,000, I meant.
email is bigballs34 at ihotmail.com.
And your
And
password?
it's Jennifer Connelly. Anyway, Eddie, what is and who is Nathan Fielder?
Nathan Fielder is a comedian from Vancouver, Canada. Got his start on a show called This Hour Has 22 Minutes. It was a Canadian kind of sketch comedy show, which kind of parody on local news, local Canadian news. That show, I mean, he's been doing funny stuff since his early 20s, and he kind of remarkably has had this really, I don't know, refined comedic voice and sense of who he is, even from then. Like, you watch his stuff from almost what, 15 years ago, and it's, I feel like, remarkably consistent with the stuff he's doing now, even after HBO budgets and, working with the likes of Sacha Baron Cohen and Benny Safdie and Emma Stone. That comedic sensibility is so consistent. And that's, so just give an example of like his early stuff on this Canadian show. Like, they did this skit where they were doing a reality TV show called Who's Tallest Canada? And the like two of the three finalists, there was this guy who was probably like 6 foot 10 inches, and then there was a little person who was probably 3 foot 5. And Nathan Fielder, just in his deadpan Nathan Fielder tone, says, "Well, we voted, and I'm sorry to say, but Tyler, you are in fact not taller." And then the little person is like, "Yeah, I mean, I kind of thought I might lose because the other guy is much taller." And that's just like the like so think really dry comedy, really deadpan delivery, and that is, part of what makes him special. Because his commitment to the bit and his devotion to the premise is unwavering, unlike any comedian I've ever come across. So, to give some examples from his previous work before The Curse, I'm quoting from a New Yorker article, which we both read. We both read it, right?
I did actually read this one. Not, I mean, I
Okay.
read everyone, but this one in particular, I did read.
So this New Yorker article chose a couple like great pieces from previous Nathan For You episodes. So after getting a start on this Canadian show, you know, this hour is 22 minutes. Which I'll share one more skit from that one. And I was reminded of this in a Vulture article. So I'll put the link to this in the show notes, as they say in the business. So this is quoting from the article, which then, you know, quotes from the show, if that makes sense. So Nathan is interviewing a matchmaker because the premise is that he's having trouble connecting with women and he wants to learn how to date better. And so he goes to a professional matchmaker and interviews the matchmaker about, you know, like pickup lines and moves he should use to better talk to women. And she says, whenever both people are feeling like they're ready in terms of a kiss, the matchmaker replies, looking a little concerned about where this is headed. And Nathan says, like, okay, you know, when are you ready? And he presses on, are you feeling like you're ready? She tries to break the tension with a joke. Sure, she says, laughing. We just won't tell my husband. Nathan goes, okay. And then he starts moving in closer and closer until she just, like, moves further away and is deeply uncomfortable. And that, I feel like that is a perfect, you know, encapsulation of the type of comedy, the kind of like awkward tension that he brings out of people who are willing to go on camera, but don't necessarily know the premise at which they're being interviewed, you know? And he delivers it with such deadpan, like, normalcy that no one expects that they're being manipulated, you know?
Yeah, I wonder. So, I mean, we can talk about a bit more about, like, his actual content, but I'm really interested in the psychology of Nathan Fielder. I think I'm unsurprised. I think probably most people that know you would be not very surprised that you are a big Nathan Fielder fan, because I feel like you also are a strong proponent of committing to the bit in situations when other people would have caved. I will say, in many circumstances, I myself would have caved, and you remain steadfast to the bit. So,
to my detriment.
I mean, not. But this is what I'm saying. I wonder if sometimes Nathan Fielder's like, if he just wishes, like, he could just do it like another show where he doesn't have to be like Nathan Fielder-y, you know?
Mm.
Where I'm sure he has other types of jokes, but his bit is so specific that if he gives in even an inch, it loses all its power. Like, the joke is that he never uncommits to the bit, you know?
Exactly. And so to quote a couple examples from the New Yorker article, so this is recounting episodes they did for Nathan For You, which is a Comedy Central show that ran for 4 years. And the premise was that Nathan Fielder is this like small business consultant, and he goes to help struggling small businesses with innovative new business ideas. And the innovative new business ideas are always absurd. And the lengths that people are willing to go to like try this out and to see it through and to be taken along with this idea get just more and more and more outrageous. And so, you know, some examples, like there's a struggling coffee shop in LA, and he says, you know, under parody law, we could make it look exactly like a Starbucks, but all of the drinks would just be called like dumb latte and dumb frappuccino. And it would be called Dumb Starbucks, and they could get away with using all the logo and stuff through parody law. And they did that, and it became like a sensation and covered by local news. And it, like, people were lining out the door to just see this thing. But then the small business completely had to take on this bit in order to survive. And so the whole renovation was done, and like, there's no going back, you know, after Nathan visits your store.
I mean, it's brilliant. I don't know if his business advice is always brilliant, but the bit, it's a no. Strong bit.
So this is quoting the New York article, but most of the humor came from watching Fielder persuade the business owners to compromise themselves. And then this is Nathan. So it's a trade-off between living longer or dying and getting to be Santa, a poker-faced Fielder tells a gentle mall clause. He's advising, whose doctor encouraged him to lose weight. In another hard-to-watch segment, Fielder convinces a travel agent to start offering funeral services to her elderly clientele as a last-ditch effort to squeeze out as much as you can from your customers before they're gone for good. Which is hilarious. And it's like, I think, I don't know, he's been criticized for being mean and, like, cruel. And I don't see it necessarily that way, because I think that enough time goes by, and obviously the small businesses know that it's an absurd idea they're not going to, you know, actually implement for the long term. But also they get a boost from just the publicity and the notoriety of being on a Comedy Central show. And then I think that there's, and we can talk about this later, but just like a deep desire to be immortalized in TV, in the American psyche. So I don't know how existential we want to get on this pod, but yeah, I mean, you were a fan of Nathan Fielder before, like, the rehearsal and before The Curse, right?
Yeah, not as big a fan as you, but I do think he's picked an interesting, and I don't know if you would think, like, you think this is true, but his choice of show or his choice of, like, reality TV that he has decided to fully commit to satirizing, which is like these, like, fake home or cooking, like fake make the American dream shows, which is kind of a niche in and of themselves. I think the brilliance of Nathan Fielder is that, yes, it's a, you know, it's, they're brilliant critiques of these shows and the people that want to make them and be on them, but it's also using what these shows represent themselves to kind of critique capitalism and society more generally. That is the part that separates him from lots of other kind of satirical productions.
Yeah, which I think that's a really good segue to talking about The Curse. Do you want to give us the premise of The Curse?
Ooh, okay. Let me see if I can. How many episodes are there now? Is it five? Have I watched five episodes?
Five, and judging on your Paramount Plus, my stalking of it, you're caught up to speed. So we're both caught up to speed on episode five, and I believe there's 10.
Okay, I was going to ask if you knew how many there were. Okay, so I've heard that the show gets increasingly more kind of dystopian, almost
just like deranged, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. But for now, the basic, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm probably going to mess up the basics. I don't go as detailed as you on your plot recaps with these shows. But I said, Yams told me the other day that she basically didn't need to watch the movies that we recap because we're so detailed. So there you go. A service.
That's like the best backhanded compliment we could possibly get.
Essentially,
you saved me 3.5 hours because
by Nathan Fielder and incredibly like brilliant Emma Stone, who just is, I think, just walks circles around everyone as an actress, which is fair because she's the only one who's like really a prominent actress. There's also a strange side plot with Benny Safdie, who Eddie has critiqued massively on this show. So I'm in the piss for other performances. I'm interested to hear, you know, if he's come through in this one. But basically, Nathan Fielder's character and Emma Stone's character are recently married, I think about a year. And they basically are the owners of this concept where they make these environmentally friendly homes that are like reflective and don't require kind of internal air conditioning. They're meant to be self-sustaining. They're pretty ugly. They're basically just like giant mirror boxes. And they're in a specific city, which is in New Mexico, called Española.
It's a real town. I looked it up.
Okay. It's in New Mexico, right?
Yeah, I thought it was fake, but it's like a real town of 10,000 people. Yeah.
Okay, so there's this town. It's kind of down on its luck. It's seen as like pretty high crime and high poverty, and they're putting in these very expensive homes, and they're trying to sell the homes and make money, but also, you know, save the environment. by creating a show through, I think it's actually through HGTV, where they kind of go with homeowners like you would see on a reality TV show where people go and tour the homes and decide to buy, not to buy. They can kind of talk up the environmental angle of the homes that they're creating. Emma Stone's character is the daughter of that she's at least taken some of their money to finance these efforts. And she kind of, I think she sees it, we're meant to see her viewing it as a way of kind of separating herself from her parents and trying to do good. Similarly, Nathan Fielder's character used to work at a casino and was responsible for putting in some pretty like appalling practices to make money off of gambling addicts for the local reservation, the local Native American group that has claims on some of this land. And so throughout this, they're trying to get this show run through not really a friend, but an old acquaintance of Nathan Fielder's character, played by Benny Safdie, who is a kind of a non-recovering alcoholic, kind of just seen as sort of a terrible person, but one with a lot of issues, who was sort of responsible for his wife's death in a drunk driving accident. And they eventually, I don't know if we, how much we want to spoil, but that is essentially the premise, and it's them trying to, you know, rebuild this town while dealing with their own personal marriage squabbles. And there's also sort of a sci-fi-esque portion, although there hasn't really been anything sci-fi about it yet. But there's a scene that is in the trailer, if you watch it, where Nathan Fielder is trying to film a short scene where he gives a girl who's selling candy in a parking lot money for, I think, soda, actually. And he only has a $100 bill on him. And so he gives her the $100 bill, but when the cameras stop rolling, he asks her for it back and says he'll go buy, get her a 20, but that was all he had. And she says she curses him. And he takes this very seriously. Later on, it's learned that all she did was curse that he wouldn't have any, I believe, cheese on his sandwich or ham on his sandwich. And that actually did come true, and that freaked him out a bit. But for now, there have been no specific consequences, though several other aspects have fallen through. Eddie, do you want to explain the side plot about his penile impotence?
So basically, there's this incredible scene with Nathan and his father-in-law, the father of Emma Stone's character, who's basically like having a heart-to-heart with him. And just like, hey, it's okay, you have a small penis. I have a tiny penis. And like somehow shows it to him eventually, but through the metaphor, they're in a garden and there's cherry tomatoes, and he's talking about how like these are like bull tomatoes, these are huge. But you and me, we're the cherry tomato boys. Look at how these cherry tomatoes are. And Nathan Fielder's character, his name's Asher, and he's deeply uncomfortable and like confronts his wife later about it. And
this one's like, fair. I feel like he gets uncomfortable about a lot of stuff, but fair enough on this one.
Yeah. And, you know, his father-in-law is just talking about like the freedom he felt when he finally opened up to all of his friends about his diminutive member. And it's hilarious. It's like it's the type of thing that would only come through in a show like this. It's played for realism and absurdity in a strange cocktail that only Nathan Fielder, I think, is capable of, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's been far more like it's one of the first like non-scripted shows that he's done, right? So it's scripted, but it's played in a way that really, you know, touches on his classic awkwardness. There's a scene at the end, his wife subtly suggests, so they get feedback from some of the test audiences, that he is not really providing anything to the show because he's not that funny. He's not handsome. He's not really speaking a lot. And so she suggests he goes to a comedy class, and he takes this kind of personally. And they're doing an exercise in the comedy class where everyone is supposed to make people laugh without making noise. And so everyone's kind of making faces and they're slowly panning around the room. And everyone, you know, making classic like clown faces, and everyone gets a, you know, people are chuckling, and it gets to him, and he goes, nobody laughs, and they just go on to the next person. And it's one of the funniest scenes I've seen in a long time.
But that is so hard.
The type of humor that he's brought to the show.
Well, just the build up to that moment too. He's so good at ramping up the tension.
There you are.
That you feel.
You cut out for a second. What did you say?
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah, yeah.
He's so good at ramping up the tension of a scene until it's almost unpalatable, and then he releases, and it's hilarious.
It is very funny.
Yeah.
It's, I have thoroughly enjoyed it so far. I'm very curious to see where it's going. And I think it has a lot of different targets. Like, I'm not sure. What would you say is like the primary thing that it's satirizing or trying to take on?
I think the thing that comes through most for me would be how much they like take the piss out of Emma Stone's character, who is very much like a just rich, white, liberal, young woman.
Right.
Like a Karen, as the kids would call it. I don't think that... I mean, I think it's more than that. I think it's doing a lot. But the main target, I would say, is like rich, liberal hypocrites.
Right. Yeah, I think that's...
White culture, liberal hypocrites, especially.
Yeah, I could see some crossover there with like the Get Out type of criticism of like upper middle class. Yeah. Like people who are politically correct, but then like just incorrect about so many more important things in the world.
Totally. They don't command the respect of people around them because they have such a double standard, right. You know? Right. In the sense of selling homes that cost $800,000 that are really environmentally friendly in a neighborhood that like has desperate poverty and is struggling to keep businesses up, and you know,
right,
like thinking that that's going to be an environmental, that they're going to start this movement through a TV show of environmentally friendly homes, and kind of like using local people as pawns for this scheme, you know, but under the guise that they're uplifting the whole community, and there's this like philanthropic effort, and they're getting people jobs, and they're only hiring locally, and they're supporting the tribe and all these things, but they're only really using it to build a brand. And I think that that would basically be the cynical way of looking at what like Chip and Joanna Gaines are doing for Waco, Texas. It's not specifically targeted towards that specific couple, but I would say it takes inspiration from that genre of show, you know?
Sure, sure. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting like race dynamics. There's Native American characters that I think like one's a performance artist and is very much I don't know, like trying to get people thinking about, she's very much like a postmodern deconstructing Native American identity and all this kind of like new age. And then they have a Native American character who's very much just kind of like a straight shooter, common sense old guy, you know, like a million dads we've met. And so it kind of doesn't really pigeonhole any particular group, I would say, other than the rich white liberals that are I don't know, the kind of thing where they will vote for candidates that say that they're trying to tackle homelessness and increase housing, but then won't actually let affordable homes and like low-income apartments actually built in their neighborhood, you know? I guess they would say NIMBYs, right? Is that the term?
Yeah. I think that's I do see, I think I see the most parallels with like the work of, I'm spacing on his name, who did Us and who did Get Out.
Jordan Peele.
Yeah, thank you. I think Jordan Peele tries to do, I haven't been as big a fan of his recent movies, mostly because there's so many great ideas and he tries to pack them into a single movie that it drives me crazy. I'm like, man, every single one of those was like a thread that I would love to have pulled all the way down on.
Yeah, they're not good.
Yeah, and some people really like Nope had a lot of brilliant ideas, but I was like, every single, like, there's no payoff. I feel like TV can work for this type of satirical television, but you really have to like fully flesh out. I think that's the most amazing thing is I heard that this show was originally like when they were even starting filming and things, they had the idea that it was just going to be like a straight sitcom, and they kind of pivoted and made it this more surrealist. I don't know if that's true, but I it seems like, I mean, he is a genius, so fair enough, but trying to actually pull off this high level satire and like a scripted show without having it planned like several and gone through like 40 different drafts would be extremely difficult, but I've been thoroughly impressed so far.
Yeah, and I feel like we should also mention the project that he's doing that he, you know, produced right before this, and that I think it's continuing the rehearsal.
Yeah. And that's mostly what the article that we read was about.
Yeah. And just how, for that show, basically, the log line is just about, like, what if you could, you know, what if you could rehearse really difficult situations before actually having to have them in person, you know, whether it be a breakup or a difficult conversation with a friend, or, and then the idea of, like, hiring actors and being able to have, you know, to practice it 80 different ways, and then to be able to anticipate all of the different paths that that conversation could take and that situation could evolve from, you know, and what if you could offer that to somebody. And so that's kind of the premise of the rehearsals. He will find, you know, people like the guy in the first episode who is part of this trivia group, and they found this guy on Craigslist, and he kind of lied or just kind of didn't correct his trivia group when they thought he has a master's degree and he doesn't have a master's degree. And he just let this like snowball over.
It's years. Just like eating him up inside.
Yeah, it's like eating him up. And no one, like, you're really doubting whether anyone else even cares. But for him, it's like a really big deal. And there's one particular member of the trivia group that he feels like would be really upset if he were to say that he misled them. And so Nathan builds on a soundstage, like an exact, and I'm saying like exact replica down to the chair and the tears in the chair and the mirrors on the wall and the, you know, beers on tap, the exact replica of this Brooklyn bar that they have trivia in, so that they can practice, you know, they can help this guy practice confessing, you know, this lie to the trivia partner. And so the show, you know, over an hour takes you through how Nathan prepared and rehearsed the conversation he was going to have with this guy named Core, you know, the guy who's doesn't have the master's degree, who's going to, you know, confess to. So Nathan prepared and rehearsed everything for that and built a replica of that guy's apartment so that he could prepare himself for that encounter. And it's all really based in, I would think, is probably a real insecurity that Nathan Fielder has, that he just has trouble connecting with people, you know?
Yeah.
And so for him, the idea that you could rehearse difficult social interactions, it's deeply appealing, and he's deeply motivated, you know, as a person for him, but also to give that to other people that maybe are socially awkward or would have difficulty with this kind of thing. That deeply appeals to me. Would that appeal to you, to be able to like rehearse something before you actually have to have it, whether it's a breakup or something?
It's hard to imagine, because I feel like the only things I ever actually rehearse for are things that suck, like giving presentations. Like, it's hard to imagine rehearsing for something that's like a normal everyday thing. I think it would drive me crazy. I think I would overthink it. I'm not sure it would be helpful, but I could see how it could be helpful for people.
Oh man, I would love it. I would jump at that in a second.
I mean, let's
here's a real conversation. I would have loved
the rehearsal. I got some exciting news for you. I'm not recording at all. This is all a rehearsal for this podcast.
That's good. That's good shit.
So you're regretting it now.
I have a perfect example of what I would
know you cut out.
Would have.
Eddie,
can you hear me?
Eddie, come back. Eddie, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, I have a perfect example of what of how I could have used his services in the rehearsal for. Well, I was 23, and I was about to get engaged to a young lady, and I went through. She was Armenian, and her family is very conservative and very Christian. And very Armenian, so that was kind of like a triple whammy, you know, in terms of just
triple whammy. Like super anti-Armenian.
No, triple whammy in the sense of how much pressure goes into the conversation of asking the father's permission for her daughter's hand, you know. It was like the traditional Armenian converging with the Christian, converging with the conservatism. Was a lot. And so I just remember that conversation vaguely going to a Panera Bread and just being completely unprepared and having no idea what I was in for, you know?
To be fair, that's how everyone who goes into a Panera Bread feels. Sucking Panera Bread.
Like, I have no recollection of it other than him asking if I would die for her. And just picture 23-year-old me trying to answer that question, you know?
Were you like right now? Like, are you about to kill me?
Like, like, oh my God, if someone came to me and said, hey, we're going to hire an actor that looks like, you know, your girlfriend's Armenian father and you can rehearse this conversation. I'd be like, oh my God, yeah. Like, how many times can we do it? Can we do it 35 times? Oh, man. Because it would have improved the results for me so much more, you know, because I would have been like, oh, I hadn't thought of that reaction. Okay. Like, now that's a possible reaction, you know, but that's how my brain works.
That comes from your, like, because I know we're both, you know, big, I don't know if we can say cinephiles, but we both watch a lot of movies. Do you think that comes from that desire for the world to be that, maybe not sophisticated, but that responsive? Like, in movies, nobody is actually as – even the quippiest people in the world are not as quippy as movie characters, right? Like, they're just ready to go with the perfect response all the time. But that is essentially what it would be like. Of course. I mean, we're on the next level. But normal people watch movies, and I think they realize that this is all scripted. Obviously, this podcast as well gives off that type of vibe. But I think – do you think that you would want to live in a world where everyone was just – super quippy, basically had thought through all potential comebacks ahead of time and everything was able to zip through like an Aaron Sorkin film?
No, not at all. What appeals to me about the rehearsal or about like that idea, wouldn't it be so that the world was just generally more interesting and people, you know, had better things to say? What deeply appeals to me about it is that it really bothers me when people react unpredictably to things I say, you know?
Mid-sentence. Eddie, can you hear us? There it is. I was telling your audience that was unpredictable, so we can play that off like it was planned.
As I was saying, no, just and I'll edit this together.
No, this is perfect.
No, but what deeply appeals to me isn't that people. would have just measurably more interesting things to say. It, what really appeals to me about it is that it just really bothers me when people I'm interacting with react unpredictably or in ways I don't predict to what I'm saying or just my social interaction, you know?
Right.
That's and fair. So that just like grates on me. I don't know. I don't know if that's a part of me I just have to grow out of, or I don't know if that's just a part of me that's always going to bother me, you know? But I think also part of that's my fault because I, for the sake of, I guess, my own sense of humor, push the envelope enough that people react and are like more confused because of my Nathan Fielder-esque deadpan delivery on some things. I'll give you an example. Yesterday I was at an event and my church had a table at this park, and I was chatting with one of my friends who was, you know, manning the table at the church. And it was just kind of like a generic Christmas, come enjoy the holidays kind of thing. And there were a bunch of vendors and stuff. And then I was talking with, later with another gal who goes to the church, who wasn't at that table. And she was like, "Oh, were you kind of sitting at her table?" And I was like, "Yeah, yeah. I made like five converts. I convinced like, you know, one person to give up his Judaism for Christianity, two Hindus, a Buddhist, and a Muslim. It was great." And, like, just straight deadpan, like, as if, and she's like, "Oh, wow." And she didn't know like what to say, you know? And I thought it was really funny, but then I had to explain, like, "Oh, no, no, of course not. Like, I would never do that. I think that's, I'm making fun of those people." I had to like walk her through the joke, you know?
It's never good when you have to walk them through the joke.
Yeah.
I see. I feel like I that like, doesn't happen to me as often. I get the opposite of like, "That was such a dumb joke that I'm going to like scoff at you." I feel like my bits aren't quite as next level, let's say, where like it requires, like, I feel like Nathan Fielder's thing works because everyone has a conception of Nathan Fielder. Or it's on TV, so people are like, "Maybe this is a bit." Whereas you're just, these are just like, TV. These are just random people who have no idea if you're a crazy person or not.
Yeah.
When it hits, it hits. I think people who know the bit are on your side here. But I think the random person portion of the bit is very funny for other people. But maybe not the best way to try to you know, get a date.
Make
out of
friends and influence people.
Situation. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. This might be more than a little reason of why I'm single.
Hey, but that's commitment to the bit, all right? You know the Chinese guy in The Prestige who carries the water bowl between his legs all the time?
That's me.
That's basically you.
That's
so
me.
I respect him.
I think there's something.
This is the trick. That's what I think every time you
but
make
that's
a joke
also,
like that.
Yeah, but that's also Nathan Fielder. When he goes on talk shows, he, like one time, he went on Jimmy Kimmel and told this outrageous story about how, you know, he was going to a wedding and he was pulled over by the cops, and on the seat of the rental car was a bag that looked like drugs, but it was actually, you know, the ashes of somebody's mother, but it was not his mother because he mixed up his luggage and he was wearing somebody else's suit and it was just in the suit. And he had explained this to the cops on the way to the wedding. And so he tells this like incredible anecdote on a talk show, and he has to spend an entire episode of Nathan For You and like $400,000 of the show's budget to go through every step of that. Because he, in the very beginning of the show, he's like, "Well, you know, it would be wrong to lie on a talk show. So, and I didn't have any other good stories to tell. So I had to do it for real."
of basically just taking the piss out of all these celebrities who go on talk shows and make shit up all the time. And also we'll just say absurd things that they, you know, that demonstrate how like wild and zany and cool their life is, you know? And there's something just so gratifying to me that even when he's not in the show, even when he's supposed to be himself on one of these talk shows or just out in the world, he's still in character, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is I think if he broke character, it would diminish all of his shows. Like, he knows that. He knows that, like, his public persona as being in on the bit is what carries the bit over. And I respect it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they're, rather than Stephen Colbert, who for many years had the Colbert Report and it was hilarious, but he was very obviously not that person in real life. But even though, but every like public appearance, he would still be in character. With Nathan Fielder, it's, that's not the totality of who he is as a person, obviously, but I think it's a strong strain. Like, it's a strong accentuation of something that actually is real about who he is, you know?
Well, I feel like if you have to commit to the bit for that long, you either become the opposite, like in more of the Stephen Colbert version, or you become the bit, right? Like, I'm sure, like, it more or less, if he's been doing that for 15, 20 years, I think he probably is more or less that person.
Yeah, that's the danger you run. But I think it's worth it.
It wasn't the AirPods, because we, guys. He's left us again.
What? You can't hear me again?
No, there it is. There he's back now. We lost you for a second.
Shit.
That's okay.
I think it's worth it.
I think so. I mean, it's brilliant. I would like to be, I mean, I got to give for once props to like TV producers for putting these shows on the air. I understand why some of these shows end up on an extension of Paramount Plus, but the fact that they're given the money to make these absurdist shows is quite brilliant and not something that would have happened any other time in American television history.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important about our culture. Like, what does our culture glorify more than anything? It's people on TV, you know, and celebrities and celebrity culture. And here's a comedian who comes along.
And podcast and hosts. Don't forget podcasts.
And podcast hosts. And here's a comedian who comes along and just holds a mirror up to ourselves and to all these people that partake in this so that they can be on TV. Because I feel like that's akin to immortality in our culture, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Then that's why it's a brilliant caricature of and American culture and the American dream in general, and not just these types of HGTV shows that he kind of models a lot of his specific shows after. What do you think, bringing it back to The Curse really quickly, what do you think about like the other characters, Emma Stone and Benny Safdie? You haven't given Big Benny any any cred.
No,
you were highly critical and it got back to him. So I don't know if he's upped his game to your satisfaction or if he's still in your
team. In this I think he's great. Just don't make him an Hungarian physicist.
I honestly think half of that was like the prosthetics. Like, he just didn't look like a normal person compared to everyone else.
I don't, for whatever reason, it really took me out of like that particular performance really took me out. But in this, he's great. Yeah, he's like I think he nails it.
I think he's quite good. His character's very hateable, but in like a very fun way.
Just to give our listeners some context for his character, he shows.
This is what I was going to say too.
He shows Asher and. What's Emma Stone's character?
I couldn't think of it. Let me think.
Whitney.
Okay, yeah, Whitney. Nice.
Asher and Whitney. He's like, let me show you some of my like previous work. And he shows them the trailer for this dating show where it's kind of like Joe Millionaire. Is that a show? Where
it's very similar to he might be really rich. Joe Millionaire, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like in Joe Millionaire, the woman thinks like this guy's really rich, but then they fall in love, and then he's like, hey, actually, I'm a, you know, teacher, a nurse. I make a normal amount of money. I'm not super rich. And then she has to decide, like, you know, she actually is a real love or she is in for money. So similarly, you know, Bachelor set up a bunch of women vying for, you know, the heart of this man. And the man is very charming and takes them on wonderful dates and everything's filmed and they fall in love in the process. But he's wearing a mask the whole time. And finally, you know, and obviously the premise is like, are you in it for the real personality, the real person? Or are you center for looks, you know? And so they, all their dates, he's wearing this mask and they're talking with great anticipation of when he's going to unmask and choose his bride to be. And then they do in the finale, and he's a burn victim and his entire face is disfigured and burnt off. And then they just show like the woman's reaction to that. And then they show Whitney and Asher's like horrifying reaction to the premise of this whole thing. And then Dougie, Vinny Safdie's character, is like, it was fine. Like, the burn victim guy thought it was funny, you know?
Yeah, it's brilliant.
It's brilliant. Because it's, we're not that far removed from that, from someone doing a show like that, you know?
I mean, it's, yeah. It's only one step further than the Joe Millionaire thing, which was, I think, trying to be winky at the ridiculousness of the other shows. So it's almost like meta commentary or meta satire. But in the end, it's all, you know, you can only satirize things so much without becoming the thing that you satirize, right? Especially if you're actually running one of these shows.
Yeah, especially if it works and it's popular and you're profiting a lot off it, yeah. You know?
Yeah. So the ironic thing is Joe probably is a millionaire now.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, Dave Foster Wallace wrote about reality shows and just, he didn't write extensively about them, but he just mentioned them in this essay he did on TV. And he said, like, what makes it so brilliant in terms of, you know, a profiteering instrument is that you make money if people hate it and you make money if people love it. So like if people believe in the artifice of The Bachelor and that maybe they are really like the earnestness of people really looking for love or second chance, or if you believe that they actually are there for that, then you'll keep watching and you'll root for certain people and then you'll root that it works out. And then if you're cynical and just think these people are idiots and see yourself as superior to them, you're also keep watching just for how much better it makes you feel out of that air of superiority. So like both viewers keep watching and that's what makes money. And so he was just, yeah, commenting on how you can make something and it can be reviled. And it can be glorified. I mean, Trump's the same way, right? Which makes sense that he comes from reality TV in terms of like politics. Like CNN made so much money during his presidency, you know, and so much like profit. And their stock, I think, has just plummeted since Biden became president, right?
I mean, pretty much all of the media. Trump being president was like a gold mine for actual finances for a lot of these media companies.
Yeah.
Which is sad, but
true. And that's why you're that's where you're gonna vote for him again.
Yeah, exactly. I'm all in it for big news.
I thought you were a Ramaswamy guy.
Dude, let's not talk politics on the air. You know, told you that in confidence.
Just, man, yikes! I don't even know. I feel like it's not worth talking about the Republican primary because it's all the candidates are so like outrageous that it just, it's not fun to take it seriously, you know? It doesn't make sense to take it seriously.
Like the first Trump administration, like it kind of killed political comedy because you can't satirize satire, right? We're talking about this ourselves. Like there was nothing you were going to say
like
that was
self-parody,
exaggerating what was happening. So I fear that we're in for a lot more of that going forward. Although, I mean, we should have an episode on like a more politics-oriented episode of just like the state of the world because the disconnection between like the actual realities of the economy and things and what how people are feeling is quite interesting. And I think it's different than any time in at least in American history. But that's not what we're here to talk about.
No, we're here to have fun.
Well, where do you think this show is going to go? Because right now, obviously, if there's 10 episodes, which we think there is. We're right at the middle. It's kind of like they got spoilers for the show. If you go watch it now and turn this off. But they got their show at least supposedly on the air, right? They're going to get financed.
They got it funded, yeah.
Kind of paid actors to be on the show rather than the real people because all the rules you had to follow were too much for an $850,000 home in a kind of down and out neighborhood. I'm very curious to see where this goes. I assume the curse portion will come back into it a bit more, but I do think that the curse could just be misdirection of their like general uncertainty and the collapse of their marriage and something to blame when really it's their own faults that are kind of bringing these things to a fore. But we'll see. Maybe there is some sort of supernatural component.
I think things are seriously going to go off the rails. I think that like Dougie, the Benny Safdie character, I think his depression, his grief is going to get worse. I think you saw it a little bit in episode 5 with Whitney kind of just shutting down once they were going to sell the house to the Blue Lives Matter guy.
Yeah.
So I think she's going to like hold that against Asher and going to tank their marriage. And then that's probably going to send Asher. That's going to make him just like flip. I think it's going to get violent. I think it's going to get deeply weird. And it's going to be great.
I hope you're right. That sounds very exciting. So I'm looking forward to that. I am curious to see what they do with Benny Safdie's character because he's funny, but I don't really know where that, like he can't really be redeemed.
How he fits in.
I don't think. Like, it's not like his character is going to be absolved. Like, he's just so morally corrupt. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the curse is. I know their curse is like a reference to the original kind of scene, but it will be interesting to see after the whole thing, like what they mean by that. I don't know. It seems to be more metaphorical than just referring to the literal like curse that the little girl put on Asher.
Right. I think you're right.
So yeah.
Well, do we recommend? What would you recommend out of 10?
The curse
so far
out of 10, like if I were to rate it out of 10,
yeah,
like an 8.5.
Okay, that's pretty good. I feel like you can't go any higher than that, only 5 episodes in. So
no, I think it's really good. I think it's definitely worth people's time. It's so different from anything I've seen before, and just the sheer anybody trying something different, especially if it's well scripted and well acted.
I mean, like, why else do we come to the Showtime extension on Paramount Plus? Like, that's what it's
for. Yeah, that's a great point. Why on earth would I even take all the clicks to get there?
Agreed. Well, I think maybe we can come back and we'll at least mention how we felt about the rest of the season on a future episode.
Yeah, that'd be great. And I hope this podcast has been illuminating for some of my maybe friends and family who didn't respect or understand who I am as a person and this entire side of me.
I think this is actually, we just made this just so everyone knows out there so that Eddie can hand and send this podcast to girls who don't understand his jokes in real time, so he doesn't have to explain them. He's just like, listen to this hour-long podcast and then get back to me. And we think this is like a foolproof plan. So